Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Suquepic people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Now, how do you move on in a place that has had to deal with a long history of marginalization, rejection, and even overt cruelty, all in the name of culture that is new on the scene, foreign to your own, and that follows principles and rules, backed up sometimes with force, that contradict your personal values and those of your community? How do you deal with this invasion that sweeps away your values, your intimate connection to the natural world, and challenges all the ways that signal home, community, and ultimate meaning? You rise from this dreadful situation by reaching deep into your culture, the family and cultural roots held in trust by the elders in your home places, and you wait patiently, often for decades, for the wisdom in which your world has been rooted to finally come out into the light. You seek inspiration from the courage reflected in your community, and especially the elders, as the newcomers slowly begin to understand and respect the truths expressed in your ancient culture, the strength and resilience gained from living in a challenging natural world and from having a strong and abiding sense of community. You reach out and learn the ways of those brash and self-possessed newcomers. And then one day, after many twists and turns, you find yourself teaching them things that they need to know to survive on this sacred planet we call home, or Turtle Island. And eventually the wisdom of both your culture and that of the invading presence begin at last to learn from one another, as the unease in that mixing of cultures very slowly begins to lessen and a certain degree of mutual respect begins to emerge. So my guest today is Nicole Redvers. Nicole is a proud member of the Deninukwe First Nation, which lives in what is called by the newcomers Treaty 8 territory and is today part of Canada's Northwest Territories. Nicole's life reflects much of the challenging process I've just outlined. She has learned over time to successfully navigate in the Eurocentric colonialist world that nearly completely swallowed up her Indigenous community. She is now working to help retain and restore the deep roots of her Indigenous culture. So welcome, and thank you very much for joining us today, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.
When we spoke a few days ago, you said, "I rarely lead with my qualifications because they don't really represent who I am." So I did what I did today, and I wanted to know, how did that introduction work for you? How did it blend with your perceptions?
Yeah, I think, for many of us, rooted within our communities is where we come from, and not only where we come from, but the people that we're accountable to. So, you know, for a lot of us, naming our communities and the land bases that we come from, it acknowledges that accountability, the responsibility and the relationship to people, which is for me who I am and what I represent and hope to walk in the world on a day-to-day basis in the best way that I can. And all of these other sort of components of honorifics or degrees are really very superficial to that in many ways. So I've never been one to be comfortable sort of stating the usual, you know, long laundry list of things, because that's not really who we are as people.
Well, I hope at the end of the show you can say you did feel comfortable here, because that's part of what it's all about. Now, you have lots of qualification, more than ample qualifications, and we'll talk about them in a few minutes. But could you just reflect a little bit on the bigger picture, the notion of the collaboration between Indigenous and settler cultures, and how you sense it's currently working or changing. You know, what's your feel of that sort of process?
Well, yeah, absolutely. There's many layers, I think, to it, because, it, you know, what is Indigenous culture in some ways? Well, it's based on Indigenous worldviews, which often are very different from other kinds of worldviews, although there's always similarities across humanity in some components. Mm-hmm. And then you have Indigenous knowledges, of course, which are often very differing in terms of its form to your Western centric knowledges. And then this idea of practice, Indigenous culture, the practice of the worldviews and the knowledges per se, is embedded in all of these other understandings of who we are and how we walk in the world. So because of that, I think we've been through many ups and downs, definitely periods of more downs based on recent history over the last 100 years, sure. But definitely an increase in the interest of Indigenous peoples in their knowledges in certain spaces, particularly around climate change and, you know, biodiversity and conservation protection in other areas. But at the same time, some recent threats, given the bleed over of the situation in the U.S. and some of the geopolitical tensions around race and what that actually means, where we do see emboldened, you know, residential school denialism and these kinds of things that, you know, would have been unheard of in some ways, at least overtly and openly 5 years ago. So we're kind of in this pull of changes, I think, in that dynamic between those two worlds.
Let's hope that that's a temporary aberration, because it's definitely an aberration. Now, your current job description, if you want to call it that, is Associate Professor and Director of Planetary Health at the Schulich School of Medicine and Dentistry at Western University. And we'll talk about that in a bit, but I wanted to have listeners understand a little bit about the long and winding road, as the song says, that you've followed over the years, going from being embodied and embedded in a small Indigenous community on the shores of Great Slave Lake to where you are now, with which is, as you said, you're the same person, but the circumstances around you have changed quite significantly. Now, you grew up in it's sort of a shared community. There's Hay River and Fort Resolution, but they're about, 70 miles apart on the shores of Great Slave Lake. I wandered around on Google Maps in the area, and it's very flat, glaciated, and the horizon is everywhere. There's just, you know, when you're in mountains, the horizon is looming up in front of you, but it's an infinite sky. It's an infinite sky. And I was just thinking, seeing the Northern Lights, as they're called, what would the term be in your language for the Northern Lights? Because they're such a spectacular phenomenon. There must be a name.
Mm-hmm. Naka is something that I've often heard for the Northern Lights. Yeah, well, there's many different representations, I think, depending on the dialects that are used. And it's it is a beautiful thing, I think, that's part and parcel of, I think growing up, not being so aware of it because it was there all the time. It's just like the mountains for you, you know, you kind of, they're there and you hear stories about them and different stories depending on the communities and different references in that kind of way. And, part of our issues with the residential school legacy, of course, is the suppression of Indigenous languages. And the consequences around that within communities have been very substantial. And in my community, quite substantial, although we see others like the Tlicho Dene groups, for example, where those language words and others are still very prevalent. And you go around community, you hear a lot of young people talk, referencing different things, whereas in others, and in ours, my community was the site of one of the residential schools, actually, was physically in that community, as well as one of the original trades of the hubs of the fur trade, that, you know, we suffered a lot of language loss. And even for my mother, knowing that the difficulties of being able to speak, and a lot of parents chose not to teach the languages to their kids out of self-protection because they were worried it was going to be, you know, a negative thing for them in their life. Although, you know, all of them listen to the radio in Denisoufane, so, you know, they understand the language,
yes,
but
indeed.
Then, you know, they don't speak it. So it's this, interesting kind of balance, I think, of for many of us reconnecting to those spaces, and really is emblematic of the challenges, I think, that come from that legacy and what that actually means today from community to community, and the differences of the experience of colonization and how that's actually affected things like language transmission. Sure.
Your mother was placed in a residential school. Placed is a sort of a euphemism. There was no choice. It was you had to do it. How over the years did you see that ramify in her thoughts, in her being, that experience of essentially degradation, both culturally and personally? What residue did it leave in her?
I don't like to share too much about other people's residential school journeys, just because it is their own journeys to share. But, you know, suffice to say, obviously, that, you know, the impact not only of my mom being a residential school survivor, but many of her siblings, her mother. So this is an intergenerational component of it. But, you know, the ultimate standpoint, I think, seen within community was, a series of cycles, I think, that went into place as a result of that affected the entire community. It wasn't exclusive to one. And that's probably the most challenging, I think, is that, you know, when you have experiences of trauma, whether or not it's a single or community-based, but when you have a whole population, you know, in its entirety and in the whole community that is not immune to the experience, it just creates a heaviness, I think, and a weight in many ways, to life, that it takes a lot to be able to take that weight off and be able to understand how to live in a world when the only thing that you've been told is that, you know, you're not good enough, and that being shamed, I think, is part of that reality from being young. And then, of course, living without love, which I think is probably one of the fundamental things we don't talk about.
It's one of the dark phases of this country's, this land's, broadly speaking, history, because it was explicitly designed to destroy Indigenous culture, and that was an explicitly stated goal. And it went on for so long that it, you know, multi-generational. Whenever I hear anybody say, and I'm sure you've had this said to you, well, you know, that was then, this is now. No. It lives on until the consciousness of those who were deeply affected by it, they've either moved on or they've taught different things to the next generation or whatever. Where you grew up is a place that is very much impacted by the world around you. The ecosystem around you is very distinctive. What part did that play in your life? I mean, when the natural world is everywhere and powerful, it has a huge impact on everybody's life. What was it like growing up in that glaciated, gigantic, sky-filled part of the world for you?
Well, when you talk about that, it makes me miss home, because that's the one thing that I always have a hard time living in cities and even with yards, because I can't see like I can back home. Because up there, you can see everywhere, at all, you know, in all directions. And it's there's always, especially growing up by the lake too, as well, it's even more amplified.
The lake is so huge. It's like an ocean.
Oh, it's massive. Yeah, it is like an ocean. It feels like an ocean when you're there. And, you know, that energy of the openness and the vastness, I think, is very much characteristic of some places of the Northwest Territories. Mm-hmm. Of course, we do have mountains on one side. But, you know, I grew up in my home community. We, at that point in time, you know, lived in a small little log house. We didn't have any running water. It was not common for that to happen. And I was remembering this last year when most of the houses had used oil drums in their living room, that the water truck would pull up and drag the hose through the house and fill up the old oil drum and put a piece of wood over it. And that's kind of how where you scooped out your drinking water for the day. But I don't recall spending a lot of time inside. Most of the time was outside. We were always outside. It doesn't matter if it was winter or summer. We were always outside on the land and doing different things. It changed a bit when we moved to Hay River, and mostly because schooling at that age or at that time didn't go very far in the community, so you had to go to other communities to be able to go to certain grades. So my parents made the decision to move us to the very big city, you know, a couple hours away, which was probably at that point, maybe 2,500 people or something. But same thing. I mean, we had cabins. We were always out. My family was hunters, used to be fishers, but not so much when I was growing up. It was mostly hunting and foraging and trapping and that kind of stuff. Very much just innate. And that's why I always find it interesting with these conversations that happen now about those connections with nature. Is growing up in those places, I don't ever remember thinking about it. It just was what it was. There was no like having to reflect or, you know, be. It was that's just right. Your day-to-day kind of life.
Yes. It has a personality of its own, and you have to adapt to its personality rather than ignore it or pretend it's not there. Did you go out hunting on the land yourself?
Yeah, my father was I wasn't so much a hunter, but I definitely was around when the hunt had occurred, cutting up meat on a very regular basis growing up. I was in charge of the meat grinding most of the time and cutting up the pieces with my family. But we definitely, whether it was, you know, plucking ducks or singeing feathers or fixing meat, making dry meat, all that kind of stuff we did. But most often in my families, and part of this was the residential school legacy, is usually the men went out to do the hunting, although we're seeing changes with that now where more women are going out hunting. I mean, we'd shoot, you know, like ptarmigans and chickens, wild chickens and that kind of stuff. But not necessarily. We all knew how to shoot a gun and definitely were able to if we needed to. But my role was mostly helping with the meat fixing afterwards.
Talk about the smells. Smell is a very important sense. It goes straight into the sort of emotional centers of the brain. And there was a smell I'm going to talk about a little bit later that you mentioned in a conversation. But what were the smells that dominated your life? Because you were living in these small buildings, there's a lot of human smells, but then outdoors, hunting. What smells take you back?
Well, it's funny you say that, because my daughters, when they were young, we lived up north before we had moved south with them. And we were away during the COVID times in the United States. And we finally had the opportunity after COVID to bring my daughter back, my daughters and my youngest. As soon as she stepped off the plane, we actually went to Yukon. It wasn't in the Northwest Territories, but she said, "Mom, it smells like home." and it was just, and she was right. It smelled like home, because the North has a certain smell, particularly in the summer and fall, which is when we go. And that's the immediate smell that I thought of was this. It's almost like we have a berry called a highbush cranberry that grows in certain area of the forest, as you know, but it's a very, lots of pine trees, or lots of spruce trees, at least where I grew up, a little bit of pine trees, but not so much. And that not very dense forest, because of the cold winters, we don't have a lot of foliage. It's, you know, you can see through the trees usually in many places, although there are areas. And there's a very specific kind of mix of high bush cranberry and spruce trees and just fresh, cool air smell that's very distinctive when you walk through the forest up there. And I've never smelled that smell anywhere else in the world that I've been.
Well, they have highbush cranberry in the little town we're broadcasting in, Salmon Arm. And indigenous people locally have told me all about the harvesting of the various crops as they come in season, and how the cycles of the season rule what you do out in the ecosystem, because they all have their own messages to pass on to you. What was it from this community and these experiences that made you at some point say, or lead you somehow to say, okay, education has to be something that I embrace in some fashion? Or how did it happen? How did it get that way?
Well, my mother, you know, in residential school, she was one of the few from her family. In fact, I think she's the only one that actually graduated high school from her, you know, large family area. And she was always very pushing in terms of us as young kids, making sure that we were always reading us books, and, you know, we had the balance between the outside. But and funny enough, later on, she became a teacher. So, you know, I'm not surprised that trajectory happened, but at that point she wasn't, but she had this innate sort of desire of teaching all of us fairly young. So I think that, that drive was sort of embedded. But also I think an advocacy and a little bit of a fight fighting spirit in some ways, which makes you want to, you know, try to explore curiosity probably, you know, as well too. But I had never thought growing up, I mean, I was told by a guidance counselor specifically that, you know, I should do the non-academic math and the, you know, this, because I wasn't going to need the other one anywhere. And this is not an uncommon experience with many students from small communities where, you know, the expectations are assumed to be low. So we're not really pushed in many ways. So it ended up, I had to pay for that later when I had to upgrade some courses, funny enough, because of advice that was given to me in the school. So, you know, it's kind of a funny journey in that way. I don't think I strove for it, but at the same time, in somehow little steps pushed me along that way.
Was the teacher from the community, or was she from the South and had been parachuted in?
Yeah, it was a non-Indigenous teacher. I'm not quite sure. I can't recall how long she lived there, or if she was there for a while, but not an uncommon experience, I'm afraid.
So you launched, and your first educational, you know, formal higher education, whatever you want to, was a Bachelor of Science in Exercise Science at the University of Lethbridge. So were you into sort of sports and stuff like that at that point?
Yeah, there was not much to do up north outside in the wintertime. You know, we did our outdoor things on the weekends, but I think anybody that comes from a northern community, if you're not playing hockey or figure skating or, you know, one of the two, then you're probably not from the north. So I was quite active growing up as a figure skater and in track and field and participated in a number of Canada games. So it was very sports orientated throughout that time frame. So originally I went into kinesiology because you know, I didn't have the grade, the math at that point to be able to do the things that I wanted to, but ended up in university walking into a wrong talk that was actually one of those career talks on naturopathic medicine, which I had never heard of before up north. Mm-hmm. We didn't have naturopathic doctors or naturopathic physicians up there, and it was very new, and you know, I was kind of mind blowing by the fact that I could still, you know, do scientific courses and learn some of the biomedical ways while at the same time be able to practice some of my own ways from community, and took the step to switch my degree, realizing that I needed obviously certain courses. Had considered medicine at that point as well too, and then had to upgrade into college at the same time I was doing university because didn't have the math that I needed. But I ended up getting A+. So whoever my guidance counselor was
you proved that the doubt
corrected my abilities.
Yeah,
I just
You proved that the doubter, including yourself, was wrong. They just you had the wrong idea.
Absolutely.
So when you got your degree, you got a Bachelor of Science in Exercise Science, and then was it straight into naturopathic school, or was there a gap?
No, it was pretty much straight in. Yeah, straight in, no break. But I did end up taking a year off. I spent quite a bit of time in Africa. For about 6 or 7 months during a gap year to do some clinical medical work over there for a while. It was pretty much straight in.
What was that like going to a profoundly different cultural milieu, but something that obviously you would have shared some things with, you know, Africa as being a target for colonial activity as much as northern Canada has been. Did you find things you shared with the people there? That you were
Very much like home. I was I had a travel bit of a bug. I did some medical work in India and Chile and different places, but Africa was particularly special for me. And I lived out in community, actually, just in a little hut with no running water and no lights for probably about 4 months of that time, hauled my own water and washed my own clothes, and, you know, it felt like home. Went to bed at 7 because the lights, you know, there's no lights anywhere. At that time, you had those small little Nokia phones.
Oh, yeah.
You know, play the little worm for about 10 minutes before you save your battery. No, it was the community orientation, the friendliness, despite obviously, you know, the intense poverty and the difficult socioeconomic status, the pure energy and dancing and singing and all of those stuff really was resonant with home. It was probably one of my most cherished times just to be able to connect in different ways, but really started to give me exposure about, oh, you know, there's Indigenous peoples in other places, being fairly isolated in the Canadian North, that also are dealing with some of these colonial issues and dealing with the poverty and very strikingly similar kinds of challenges occurring.
When you went into formal training at naturopathic medicine, one of the things that you commented on was the fact that you could use traditional medicines that you were familiar with from your childhood, as well as learning something about sort of the Western science approach to things. But one thing you mentioned, I talked about smells earlier, because I'm very aware of how people respond to those kinds of things. Everybody does. The smell of your grandfather's bear grease. Why don't you talk about that? That obviously, it doesn't take much for it to come up in your mind when your mind turns to it. What was he like in your life, and what was his bear grease remedy?
My grandfather died when I was quite young, but I have very vivid memories of him. He was a strong hunter and very traditional man overall. And he always had bear grease around, and he actually used it in his hair. I think it was like, you know, you can't buy hair gel back then, so that was sort of the way that you... And then a lot of people would rub it on their joints, like an arthritic sort of treatment, or on skin kind of issues and that kind of stuff. So there was always the smell around at some point, you know, of bear grease that was... you know, you can recognize it anywhere. Nothing else really smells like that. So it's very characteristic in many ways, but powerful.
And do you have any way of describing what it's sort of like? It's not like anything else, but is it similar to anything that anybody could identify?
It's kind of maybe like a bacon grease kind of, once it's solidified, a little bit firmer than that, maybe. And people these days, they'll mix it a little bit with, beeswax or something like that to get it a bit more cream-like, you know, the modern day interpretations, but the old school stuff just with the, you know, the refined fat is, you can rub it pretty good.
What naturopathic training gave you was a sense of what you described as flexibility and freedom. Western medicine, and I would agree with this, is narrow, and it's got some very distinctive habits that are related to intellectual property rights as much as they are to science. If you can patent something, then you're interested in it. If you're not able to do that, then you're not. You went back with this training to the Northwest Territories, and started a practice. Where was the practice, and how did it start off in a world which, my guess would be, initially was not particularly accepting of naturopathic medicine alongside conventional, you know, doctor type, you know, MD type medicine?
Well, the first year I practiced actually as a home-based practice because I was still breastfeeding my first. But interestingly enough, before I started practicing, I got a letter from the medical regulator of the Northwest Territories threatening me with jail time and a monetary fine for calling myself a naturopathic doctor, because at that point we did not have license or regulations. So somebody had complained, likely a physician, to the regulating office. Anyway, it ended up starting a whole process of advocacy, obviously. Obviously, I was licensed, like in many other professions in the Northwest Territories, you hold a license in another province because, you know, even for physicians and others at that time, it was very similar. But, created a process of emboldening our deputy national assembly and our chiefs to be able to put forward. And 10 years later, we did end up, as a result of that, getting licensure in the Northwest Territories, including drug prescribing as well. So it was a nice little flick off. If that didn't happen, I probably wouldn't have set the place on fire in terms of trying to get the movement forward with the legislation. But ended up a year later opening up an interdisciplinary practice. By the time that I was leaving, there was about 18 of us, I think, in there, a mix of psychologists and counselors and physiotherapists and massage therapists and chiropractors and naturopathic doctors and others, with a quite a good referral network with local physicians. But, you know, it was definitely a slog at the beginning, the first 2 to 3 years, as people, as you know, don't know a lot about this. But I think because it was the Northwest Territories, because we have a majority Indigenous population, it was very hard for them to overtly say to me, as an Indigenous woman, that, you know, you can imagine the political sensitivities around that. So in some ways, that was to my favor for the advocacy and the education, but ultimately, it didn't come down to what I did or what I said. It was patients themselves that were presenting to their own family doctors, given that it is a small town with improvements in varied conditions, that, you know, then the eyebrows start to perk and say, okay, well, you've been dealing with IBS for 10 years, and all of a sudden, you don't have symptoms anymore. What are you doing? And then I would start getting the emails, you know, what are you doing? And that kind of built the relationships to now a number of physicians, you know, and ended up winning, which I was quite shocked by, the in 2017, I think, the Northwest Territories Medical Association award from the Doctors Association. So that was a nice symbol, I think, for me, that the work was not about what we did or, you know, all of these sort of debates that happen, but really about the impact to healthcare and to the health of people in the North.
I was also involved as a physician in complementary and alternative medicine, the sort of generic term for anything other than, you know, drugs and surgery. And the role and the social role of diversifying into those kinds of, the kind of practice that naturopathic physicians would use within the medical field was also frowned on initially. But eventually there was a group called the Association of Complementary and Integrative Physicians of BC, formed in Victoria. And, you know, we were putting on conferences with titles like When the Body Forgets to Heal. In other words, looking at the whole picture of what healing is all about. And I think that trend now, and what you've described, was actually even more, you know, when you're living in an environment where, first of all, the population is not huge, and secondly, as you say, Indigenous majority, it's very hard for the conventional-minded physicians to be quite so arbitrary. They've got too much to push against to be able to keep doing it all day long. It was a very successful clinic, but one of the things you mentioned in one of your comments, you said that you'd been frustrated by the fact that many health issues facing Indigenous peoples were structural and systemic. They were not just, you know, individual problems brought about by individual behaviors or circumstances. And that led you to crossing the border into the, at that time, much less fraught United States of America, because there was in the Dakotas, there was a special place you could go to. Why don't you talk about that destination that led you across the 49th parallel?
Well, I got a little bit of a teaser because I ended up deciding to do a master's of public health in the U.S., although I had to travel back and forth from Yellowknife, which was quite the feat, and really started to get me thinking about these structural issues, just as you've noted, you know, was increasingly frustrated that, and most often it would end up being, you know, stage 4 cancer patients that would come to see me first because they hadn't trusted the system and ignored, you know, and majority Indigenous patients. And I kept thinking, you know, if somebody can't in this day and age at that time, you know, not feel safe to go seek care, then this is a problem, and nobody's addressing this issue. And nobody was back then. You know, we didn't have the cultural safety terms. There was none of this kind of stuff happening. So that public health degree really opened my mind to, oh wait, there's another way to do this. You know, and an opportunity came up at the University of North Dakota's School of Medicine and Health Sciences, where they were in the early stages of starting to think about developing a PhD program in Indigenous health, which had not been done in North America, let alone the world that we know of at that point in time, although there was a Maori PhD that was somewhat health-focused in New Zealand. And that was enough of a trigger where it was going to be full Indigenous faculty in a dominant Indigenous program, and thinking, oh, wow, maybe, you know, if we can train 10 or 15 of these PhD students coming out with doctorates that can now help to support solving and, you know, these structural issues, then what am I going to do in isolation? Anybody can be in the clinic room. You just need skills and training. I mean, obviously, there's going to be differences depending on the people, but to attack those larger issues, you need to have a little bit more lived experience and be cognizant of what the challenges are. And that opportunity excited me.
Mm. The degree you got was a Doctor of Philosophy from the University of North Dakota. And at the person who was responsible for this exceptional circumstance was Dr. Donald Warren, who was himself an Oglalala from Pine Ridge. Interesting, the scene of just looking at the context of relations between settlers and Indigenous people was the scene of a violent conflict where Leonard Peltier was identified, and he just got out of jail in February of last year after 50 years, a half century in jail. I brought it up because I'm interested to know how, when you hear of something like that or you are aware of something like that, how it kind of filters through your consciousness, knowing that there are still people being punished for being who they are. It's not just Indigenous people right now. It seems to be a whole range of people, especially south of the border. But when you hear stories like that, how does it flow through your mind?
And just a note, I didn't get a PhD at the University of North Dakota. I helped develop one. Okay. My PhD is across the other pond in the UK.
I know there were two universities. I was going to mix them up.
No worries. But yeah. I mean, the U.S. is, it was a whole very much an eye-opening experience for me, because on one hand, you see the U.S. as, you know, being behind in many ways comparatively to the Canadian context. At least, you know, that's the visibility. But once I went down there and saw, you know, these Lakota and Dakota and Ojibwe, you know, tribal communities, whether it's Standing Rock or Pine Ridge or mm-hmm. or otherwise, mm-hmm. and Turtle Mountain, many of them have way more sovereignty than we do up north. Mm-hmm. You know, they have their own license plates, their DMVs, they run their own health systems, they have their own education programs. So I was kind of going like, what is going on here? Why are we not having all of this? This is amazing. And, you know, at the same time, just as you've noted, the political suppression, the very heightened tension, and, you know, South Dakota specifically, you know, noted the Pine Ridge Reservation, which is probably one of the poorest in the entire U.S. with the same health outcomes as Haiti, which, of course, is, you know, a country which is basically, you know, in disarray, yet we have the same health outcomes happening in Pine Ridge and in South Dakota, being very much pressured by mining companies to be able to mine uranium out of the Black Hills, offering big, big money, and yet tribes turning them down and states being upset. So there's all of these tensions that happen there, and it's unfortunately increased, as you've noted, but it's very difficult and challenging. And for me, it's it was an awareness that these kinds of fights are not over. Yes, there's been a lot of progress in many areas, but there's still a lot of work to be done in ensuring the rights of Indigenous peoples in so many places. Yet some are a little further ahead in others, even though they might have less political freedom, they might actually have more freedom in their education system, or vice versa. So it's this interesting dance of levels of sovereignty that people are applying based on the circumstances that they're in.
I love that phrase, dance of various levels of sovereignty, because it really is. I mean, it's something that goes this way, that in the morning, and that way in the evening. It's fluctuating all over the place. Talk a little about Donald Warren. He was an exceptional leader within Indigenous health circles. He's now at Johns Hopkins in a prestigious position there. What was his influence like in terms of your understanding of things?
Yeah, I would definitely call him a very key mentor for me. I never had Indigenous, you know, mentors growing up, whether or not it was people within the school system or teachers or faculties or doctors, even. I had never been exposed to that. So to come to an environment where I could have an Indigenous physician as my boss, you know, in addition to being with other faculty. And Donald Warren is an exceptional human being, and in fact is in the process right now of developing the very first Indigenous medical school in the United States to be in Rapid City, South Dakota. And he really taught me how to operate in these academic and political spaces, because I was coming from the North. You know, we have a certain culture up there. Yes, I'd been around the world traveling, but it's very different when you're dealing with, frankly, you know, a lot of white men in medical schools that have very, you know, specific power dynamics. And he was able to just navigate that system. So I watched him closely and traveled with him and worked with him. And, you know, it was really a key stepping stone for me. And he really opened up a lot of opportunities and enabled me to get out into different spaces that I 100% would not have without his mentorship and support. So I'm very grateful to him for that. And also, our families were bubbles during COVID. So his kids are the same age as my kid, and they became family.
In the middle of all this, you wrote a book. The book's called The Science of the Sacred, Bridging Global Indigenous Medicine Systems and Modern Scientific Principles. That gave me inspiration for the introduction. You know, this notion of the two worlds, you know, the clash of worlds people talk about sometimes, but it was definitely a clash of worldviews. And this book clearly was an important piece in the reintegration of healing processes and the amalgamation of different approaches to how you do that, recognizing that there was a sort of power imbalance. Primarily, you talked about having to deal with a lot of white men, but there was a power imbalance within the systems as well. This system is a good system, that system is an inadequate system. And your book made it crystal clear that was a complete misapprehension by people with prejudice built into their perceptions of things. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. I think I grappled with the, you know, apparent complexity that people were putting on this topic of you have this system and this system, and this is a good system and this is a bad system, and that sort of polarity of talk within medical circles, primarily of, you know, you're either science-based or you're not, and it's black and white, and that's that. And, you know, that pervasiveness, I think, and perhaps I saw that more because I was, you know, practicing as a naturopathic doctor and seeing the other side, whereas people within medical circles maybe, you know, wouldn't have seen that as much in terms of experience. But, you know, from an Indigenous perspective, obviously, it just seemed crazy. And why are people not being able to better bridge these circumstances to understand that it's not black and white? There's a spectrum. There's always a context. The context is important for people, for communities, and in medicine. And if we're not thinking about this in a systems holistic way, then we're going to continue to get sicker. And I saw that in patients, you know, that had that system forced upon them, where their cultures were not recognized, their sovereignty of choice was not recognized, while at the same time, you know, being mindful of the balance of misinformation and disinformation and all of these things that do pervade some spaces too, and how to be able to navigate that and separating out our traditional Indigenous sort of practices from maybe some of these more mainstream alternative complementary things that may not have been derived from our traditional practices and sometimes, you know, may lead to harm if they're not done in safe ways. So that book was really about grappling with it. And I didn't have a plan when I started writing it. You know, it's kind of funny. I was always a bit of a science nerd. And I had in my brain that there's got to be a way to put these things together to explain Indigenous concepts in a way that science people would understand. That was the original motivation. And then it just kind of went full circle. The systems approach, you know, through the different categories of whether or not it was physics or physiology, just sort of naturally came without a plan, per se.
You just what you were saying now about these various background experiences in your work at the Schulich School at Western University, you said something about my STEM, and I had to look up STEM because I'd forgotten what it stood for. It stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics. My STEM background, and I noticed some of the other people in the school use the word STEM quite liberally. It seems to be a popular honorific, indirect honorific. But in a way, there's so much science, there's so much empiricism in indigenous knowledge. It's based exclusively on direct experience with the things that are happening, as opposed to people reading a theoretical book or being taught out of a manual. And it seems to me that that's the one profoundly different characteristic. You can't pretend to understand where the moose are going to go. I mean, just to take an animal analogy, unless you know exactly what influences their behavior, you have to know it intimately. You have to become one with the animal in a way, which with Western science, you can teach it out of a book and you can say, this is the way things are. These are the average numbers. And then you treat everybody as if they were average, which of course never works very well, but it's sort of sanctioned in the Western tradition and not in empirical indigenous teaching. Would that be a fair characterization?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say, one interesting comparison I noted, being in a medical school where I was teaching predominantly indigenous students in the U.S. and then moving to Schulich here at Western, where it's predominantly non-indigenous students, is noticing very clearly, and I don't think I was aware of this before, how much the non-indigenous students had issues with uncertainty. And what I mean by that is that, you know, I think people are taught so much in a box that, you know, your grading rubrics, and this is where you need to be, and you need to memorize this list, and this is how you apply it. This is the checklist and the algorithm. If somebody has a sore throat, you work down, which is, important, and there's guardrails in place that are there. But the problem is that when you're in a family practice, life doesn't operate like that. I mean, any family physician knows that these things are not black and white. There's a lot of complexities to it. And I noticed that Indigenous students actually thrived with the, that kind of state of uncertainty. In fact, they became more creative and lots of things flowed from it. So it was a very distinct difference working with those two. And I don't know if I would have noticed if it wasn't, such a dominant group of Indigenous students and non to be able to see that. And I think that's kind of reflected in what you said. It's, it's funny how we put ourselves in boxes in many ways in medicine, which works when you're in, doing an open heart surgery. And you need to have some certain parameters in place. But if you're dealing with depression or anxiety or PTSD or IBA, irritable bowel syndrome, some of these things, you have to have a little bit more of an open perspective to be able, you're dealing with people now, and that becomes much more complex and uncertain.
Yeah, when you're dealing with a person, the whole person, then you have to accept that you're both swimming in the water and you have to hang on to each other in order not to drown. Now, we must, mm-hmm. we're getting close to the end of the hour, but I wanted to bring up with you the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and the role that it played in bringing forward what we've been talking about up till now, which is these two worlds coexisting in a very, very uneasy relationship because of the power imbalance and the hubris of Western societies in their assessment of what's going on. It started in 2008. Well, already got started in 2009. It had a bit of a kerfuffle at the beginning with the leadership, the change, and then Dr. Murray Sinclair took over, and he steered it through the rest of its time. And it really did change just about everything in terms of awareness and in terms of insight into the kind of fractured history of relationship between Indigenous and settler communities. How did it affect you and what you were doing in all the things you were doing? It changed the universe in some respect. Certainly this part of the world changed the universe.
it was incredibly important, and especially now, you know, working in various countries around the world, noticing how important that TRC was for us to be able to get things done in Canada comparatively to other places like the US or even New Zealand and most of Australia, which has not had those kinds of TRC processes and the barriers that have been put in place. So it becomes, you know, even more notions. But for me, it has allowed for an advocacy point that's either a policy guidance, and then, you know, even with the establishment of things like the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples legislation, something to turn to when we were advocating, for example, to develop an urban land-based healing camp in Yellowknife. And the need and why that was important for us to do was because of certain TRC points that were listed in there. And we were, you know, attempting to fulfill or clear gaps within those areas. So it did allow for some policy alignment of initiatives that we can be very strategic in saying, you know, this is the work stream, this is why it's important. And we now know that you understand this context of why it's important, but we're just mapping sort of the solutions and the programs on the ground now to where it fits into this map that you've, you know, kind of agreed upon and created. And then frankly, the work in the university, you know, for us as Indigenous faculty to be doing what we're doing, even in medical schools, was unheard of 15, 20 years ago. It was, and if it was being done, there was, you know, it was being often pushed back against from what I've heard from people, you know, in those stages, or suppressed, and people couldn't publish in medical journals around Indigenous knowledges. So definitely the TRC was a key change point within the Canadian landscape that unfortunately others around the world haven't benefited from in their country context to date.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation about the role of language and how important language was, and being not allowed or allowed or allowed to expand or contract your own relationship with language. And it, one of the outcomes of the TRC was the development of a language development process. The commissioner, Ron Ignace, who's Shkrepmek, and wrote, he and his wife wrote a book called Shkrepmek People, Language and Laws, which is really a classic. It's huge, and it contains an incredible amount of information. And I have a copy sitting on my shelf, and I've read chunks of it here and there. There were three directors, one for each, for Indigenous, for Inuit, and for, what's the third one?
Métis, yeah.
Métis, yeah. The Robert Watt, I'm sure you know Robert Watt, he's the Inuit director in this language commission. What role is formally saying we have to promote and support and underpin language preservation and use in just changing the whole mindset of people?
It's incredibly important and very minimized. In fact, you know, I've often said that Indigenous languages revitalization is a public health intervention, because we know very clearly from the evidence that Indigenous communities that have higher levels of language, traditional language use, have better health outcomes overall. This has been very clear. And Indigenous languages are often verb-based comparatively to many other languages, which are noun-based. And because of that, each concept or terminology or item has a story embedded within it. It's not just a thing. There's an action that it does, or some sort of component that weaves this kind of narrative of understanding of the world that bridges this interconnectedness. So even for me as Dene, day means flow, ne means land. So, you know, we flow from the land. That's what Dene is. We're not Dene as a person. We're flowing from the land. That's who we are. And that view of the world is embedded within the structure of everything in terms of the function. And because of that, that's why we see the importance of languages holding much of the traditional ecological knowledge that we all require for those Indigenous peoples to hold and steward, so that they can continue to steward their land and in fact, the majority of the remaining biodiversity on the planet. So it's not only for the health of Indigenous peoples, it's for the health of all, and all is embedded within this fundamental blueprint of languages as a narrative of interconnectedness with land, our understandings of story, but also this relational aspect of being in the world that we've very much lost in many other societies, and hence why we see the harms today, not only with climate change and biodiversity loss, but also in the rates of anxiety and depression in our youth.
Indeed, indeed. I'm so sorry we've come to the end of the hour, because I have lots of other things I wanted to talk with you about. But I certainly thank you very much today for sharing a story that I think has universal aspects, but also very specific time and place connections. And it's part of the history of life, of human life on this continent, and probably an evolving process that is spinning a little faster these days as we start to realize some of the mistakes that have been made, and we work hard to correct them, because we all have to do it. We all have to participate in it. So your actions of bridging between sort of Western science and Indigenous knowledge are something that we all have to be participating in, and you've certainly laid it out for us in very clear terms, for which I thank you, and I'm sure our listeners will thank you as well. It's been lovely talking to you, Nicole. Thank you.
Merci, Cho. Thank you for having me.
Cookstamp.